The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Forum, the weekly program in which we bring prominent personalities to the microphone to discuss important topics of the day. Here is William Clark, journalist and commentator, to open the program.
This is William Clark introducing this week's London Forum. The subject that we're going to discuss is, can the United Nations be both a world organization and an effective instrument against aggression? And round the table we have representatives of the three major English political parties. There is Quintin Hogg, who was a Conservative Member of Parliament until he succeeded recently to his father's title, Lord Hailsham. There's Dingle Foot, who is a Liberal, and who was a member of the British delegation to the San Francisco conference which founded the United Nations, and Christopher Mayhew, who was a Labour member of the last Parliament and Under Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Now, I think the first question that we want to ask is the first part of the question, and that is, can the United Nations be a world organization? Should it be a world organization? Foot, what do you think?
Well, it was certainly intended when the organization was set up 5 years ago that it should be universal or very nearly universal. And it seems to me that that conception of universality is really the foundation of the Charter. Because what we wished to do in San Francisco was to set up an organization whose rulings, at any rate in certain circumstances, would be accepted by the whole world. And I don't see how they can command that acceptance unless nearly all the nations of the world are inside. It doesn't mean to say that they must all agree in every case with what is done. But at any rate, they must have a chance of being heard if they're to be bound by what the United Nations does.
Hogg, what have you got to say to that?
Politically, I entirely agree. The thing which has happened since the last 3 months is that the United Nations has come alive. It started by being a purely legal, even a legalistic conception founded upon the Charter, but it has developed into being a political idea for which men and women have already died. And that idea involves of necessity that it should be a world organization with an authority over the peoples of the world. And that, I think, must necessarily involve a certain degree of universality in its membership.
Mayhew?
Yes, there are obvious advantages in universality, and I think it's monstrous that countries like Italy and ERA should be denied membership. But at the same time, when we study the performance of some of the dictator countries inside the United Nations, and when we remember that the Charter lays down that member nations are supposed at least to have certain minimum standards of civil liberties, I'd be against admitting further members such as Spain and Bulgaria and Hungary at the present time.
Hogg?
I should have thought that that was precisely the reason for admitting them. Supposing you do take the analogy of a world authority, nobody thinks of not admitting potential criminals to the membership of a state. It's precisely because you want to discipline them for their bad morals that you make them members of the state. If you excluded them, you'd have no hold over them at all.
Yes, but I'm sure Hogg belongs to a number of clubs himself. Would he admit all the criminals to his clubs as for the specific purpose of reforming them, or would he not lay down certain standards for their admission?
No, but when you enter a club, you accept certain obligations.
Exactly.
And it seems to me that you're in a much better position to make people observe those obligations if they're inside than if they're outside.
Well, I shan't join Hogg's clubs if he's going to admit all the criminals on that basis.
I don't think that my clubs would admit members of your party, Mayhew. But if I may say so respectfully, you are being misled by your analogy. A state is not analogous to a club. A state is a thing which disciplines people irrespective of whether they are willing to admit their obligations. A club is a body of like-minded people who are willing to undertake them.
Isn't that just the point that we've got to decide for ourselves? Do we want the United Nations to be a club of like-minded people, or do we want it to be the basis for something like a world state? Mayhew?
Well, of course, this is very topical because the whole question of Korea, which is in all our minds today, raises the question as to whether the Soviet Union should be a member of United Nations. I think everyone must have been struck by the extraordinary contrast between the actions of the Security Council on the 25th of June, the day after the attack on South Korea, the promptness, the vigor, and the effectiveness of the Security Council actions then, when Soviet Russia was off the Council, and the complete mess that began on the 1st of August when Mr. Malik returned to the Security Council. He boycotted, of course, the Security Council because he wouldn't sit down round the same table as the nationalist Chinese delegate. But what struck, I'm sure, most people was this extraordinary contrast. And in all our minds is this question: suppose it all happened again. Suppose it happened again, suppose some other country was brutally attacked and Russia was on the Security Council, able to use her veto and obstruct. Now, what do we all do then?
Good. Well, we all know perfectly well what would happen. That under the terms of the Charter, the United Nations could take no action whatsoever, unless they were to take it in pursuance of the article which confers the right of individual and collective self-defense. But the obligations would only bind those nations which chose to take part, and there would be no general obligation on all the members of the United Nations.
In other words, if that chain of reasoning were allowed to prevail, the United Nations as a living organization and idea would die in dead formalism and legalism. The vital thing would be to see that we did do exactly what has been done despite the veto. And the only question is how to do it.
That's right. Yes, I entirely agree with that. We can't accept the situation where the real vitality which we've bred in the United Nations now, which has made a tremendous impact in Korea, we can't let that get dissipated. I agree with that.
I remember talking about the United Nations in 1945 with Senator Vandenberg, that he said, eventually the day will come when the real crisis arises for the United Nations. Action will be voted for and vetoed, and then the United Nations will die, and in the next room, the Grand Alliance will be born. The question that we're faced with now is whether or not we can keep the United Nations alive and make it an effective instrument in world politics.
You know, I don't think it's good enough to wait until that moment of time arrives. Because, taking your illustration from Senator Vandenberg, everyone would choose whether he went into the next room or not. And therefore, you've got to have some supplementary organization, so to speak, within the United Nations in order to make it work in spite of the veto. I mean, the point seems to me to be this, that if at this moment the United Nations arrive at a decision that they're going to take action, as in the case of Korea, there can be no neutrals among the members of the United Nations. No other member is entitled to give any support or comfort whatever to the declared aggressor. If you merely leave it to a grand alliance formed at the very last moment of time, then it only binds those who want to come in at that particular moment. Seems to me that's a very important distinction.
Hogg, what have you got to say?
I entirely agree with what Foote has just said. It would be the greatest possible pity if we had to wait until the moment when the Grand Alliance came in order to achieve what has to be achieved. I think it would mean, just as Vandenberg said, the death of the United Nations and the birth of something different and inferior. Rather than see the living idea, the spirit behind the United Nations die, I would face even that.
Mayhew, I wonder, we seem to have arrived at the situation where we're discussing the possibility of the United Nations dying. What is it that has been causing so much trouble within the United Nations in its 5 years of existence? What do you think has been the fundamental flaw?
I think there's no question whatever the trouble's been that we haven't had that basic minimum of cooperation between the great powers on which the whole idea of the United Nations and the Charter was based. Right from the beginning, the Security Council has been stultified by the Soviet use of the veto. Now, I myself am in favor of the veto as designed. But when Soviet Russia uses it for every trifling point of procedure and stultifies the work of the Security Council, that's just not good enough. And I'm very glad to see that people are discussing the possibilities of other ways round. Mr. Acheson's proposals for the Assembly, some people are saying that perhaps we should try to expel the Soviet Union from the United Nations. I don't know if any of us here would agree with that.
Well, you know, why do you try and draw distinctions between veto when it's rightly used and the veto when it's wrongly used? If you have a great power veto, which any one of the five so-called great powers can use at its discretion, it means that that power is the judge and is the sole judge at the right occasion to use the veto. It's no use taking refuge in saying that you don't believe the veto should be used so often, because there will always be differences of opinion about the correct occasion to use it and when it's legitimate. You've got to modify the system if you're going to get anywhere.
Were you aware of that foot at the time of the discussions in San Francisco?
Well, I was from the beginning. And I personally, I don't want to go into what happened 5 years ago, personally, I always thought that this overriding veto was a mistake.
Then why was it that the veto was adopted as part of the United Nations Charter?
Well, it was adopted, I think, chiefly in order to induce the Russians to come in. It was thought, rightly or wrongly, particularly by those who met at Yalta, that the Russians would not join in any world organization unless they had the power of the great power veto. Personally, I've always wondered whether that was so, whether if we'd gone ahead without it, the Russians really would have stayed out or could have afforded to stay out. But at any rate, that was the view that was taken then. And as far as the British government was concerned, the veto was the price that was paid for Russian participation.
Well, that, I think, Foote, puts us in rather a clear difficulty. You see, I entirely agree with you that it's no good trying to draw distinctions when you've given a person the right of veto, as Mayhew has tried to do, between cases when it's rightly used and cases where it's wrongly used.
May I just interrupt there, though? I mean, surely you won't defend the use of the double veto. That is to say, as we all know, procedural matters can't be vetoed. And therefore we get to the situation where somebody introduces a resolution to say that a matter is substantive, and the Soviet Union vetoes that resolution, and therefore can control the complete agenda of the Security Council, whether it's procedural or not. Now, that's an abuse.
I'm not defending the use of the double veto,
nor
the way in which the veto is being used. The point that I was making was this, that unless you are prepared to change the whole system whenever you get the chance, it's no use complaining as to the way in which the veto is used.
Yes, and the difficulty you're in there, Foote, if I may say so, is precisely this. I absolutely agree with your argument. But once you have conceded that the Charter provides for the veto, that there is no means which cannot be vetoed of altering the Charter, and that the veto was the price for getting Russian adherence, you're going to get a pretty formidable argument from the Russian delegates based on the legality and the constitutionality of your argument when you propose to introduce a system which bypasses the veto.
Well, I think that's perfectly true. But if the United Nations is to be effective at all, we have to find some way of bypassing the veto.
I think that's really the point that we've come to. We now realize that what has gone wrong with the United Nations in its 5 years of life has been the constant use of the veto, about which we had doubts at the time in 1944-45 when the United Nations was being founded. But the question now is, are we going to abandon the United Nations as a show that won't work, or are we going to try and find some way round the veto? Now, amongst the ways that has been suggested of getting around the veto is that, which really amounts to expelling those who abuse the veto. I don't know whether anyone feels that that does have any virtues as a system of, as a method of getting around the problem of the veto.
Well, Clark, the point surely is this. You cannot constitutionally expel a member for exercising its legal rights.